Okay. Yeah, so thanks for coming again. This is an interview for the Tel Aviv Review of Books, and it's going to be like an extra on the website when the next issue comes out in a couple of weeks. And I had a really good time reading both of your books. It was really interesting and enjoyable, especially because it's a topic that's so fascinating for me personally, and learning about the reason, especially from an Iranian perspective, is my own thing.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to ask first is, like, you both went to Syria and Iraq and elsewhere. How did you get into, like, how did you get into covering the region to begin with? It's not every nice Jewish boy is going to Kobani and wherever.
Jonathan's the start. He did it first.
Oh.
Chronologically.
Chronologically. Okay. Well, there's a number of aspects, really. I mean, I finished a PhD, and then I knew that I didn't want to become an academic. So then I started, and I'd always been kind of dabbling in journalism as a side thing going back to the early 90s. So I decided to start taking that more seriously and moving away from the notion of becoming an academic. And then, you know, myself and I think Seth also were very involved in this country during the Second Intifada, when there was obviously that stuff going on that was kind of quite focused here. Then that ended. I was in the Lebanon War in 2006, and for me, for various reasons, don't have to go into huge detail, but for me, like, that was a reason when I decided, okay, I don't want to work in the Israeli public service. Like, I don't want to be an Obed Medina, I don't want to work for the state. Not that I'm against the state, I'm not against it, but I don't want to be in that Marechet. Which actually, all that together kind of left open and obvious in a certain way the field of journalism and the field of foreign correspondence. Mm-hmm. And I did my first reporting trip to Lebanon in 2007. And then...
A year after the war?
Yes. And then I began to write more about the region for the Jerusalem Post and then gradually for other publications too. In 2010, I did my first trip to Iraq to interview the PKK leadership. And then the obvious bit is coming. And then, of course, in 2010, 2011, the region was busted wide open. History returned to the region. Fascinating, amazing, astonishing stuff was taking place in country after country. And for me, Syria through Lebanon had become a kind of central interest in any case in some time during that period, gradually over time. And so I had a lot of context in the Syrian opposition. So then when the Syrian war began in 2011, I immediately began, you know, pestering my contacts and friends to say, look, I need to get in. Can you help me get in? And then in February 2012, after a lot of messing about, that finally bore fruit. And that was my first trip into Syria, to Idlib province at that time. And then I've been many times to Syria and to Iraq since then. And it's become, in lots of ways, my central focus and interest. And that's it, really. And you know, I hadn't really better thought of being a war correspondent. I wanted to be a Middle East correspondent. But when the Middle East ends up being about war, you become a war correspondent too, you know? That's it.
Yeah, I have a sort of similar trajectory. Like, I came here to do my master's and PhD. And I got the MA and I guess I got the PhD around 2010 or so. And I always liked dabbling in journalism a bit because I was writing sometimes as a columnist and stuff like that. And I didn't know that much about the wider Middle East. I think I was interested in doing Middle East studies a bit as a master's student or a PhD student, but I trended towards doing a bit more about like Ottoman British Palestine, so kind of more narrow. Like, didn't know much about Syria or Iraq except what I'd read in the news. Like, I mean, I remember Iraq as a formative experience in the 90s or whatever. Like, I was interested in that respect. So I think I started teaching at Al-Quds University after I got my PhD, and I was lecturing in American foreign policy to Palestinian students, and I spent a lot of time covering riots in the Palestinian territories. And then I was, you know, I was involved in or on the border during the 2009, 2012, and 2014 wars with Gaza. I think the 2006 war, I kind of glanced, just went over me because I think I was studying or something. I didn't really deal with it. But I was very interested in the Gaza conflict and stuff like that. And then this whole Arab Spring thing happened. And I think in 2014, after the ISIS, you know, the genocide against the Yazidis began, and you were able to watch videos of it. I remember sitting in Beit Hanina and watching a video of people being beheaded and stuff, or machine gunned in Sinjar. And I decided that I felt it was important to go cover that somehow. But before doing that, I think I first went to Turkey to do a little bit of correspondence there. And then the next year, I went to, with a friend named Laura Kelly, we went to Iraq. And the rest is kind of history. I just, like him, I kept going back again and again. I got very addicted to it. And I very much wanted to try to cover as many countries as I could. So I went back to Turkey, I went to Jordan, Egypt, I went to the Gulf to do some coverage there. And I never went to Syria or Lebanon. I felt it was too difficult or dangerous. But certainly Iraq and the Kurdistan region was something I felt very comfortable in. And I felt it was important to do it. Mm-hmm. I think as an Israeli or someone who's, you know, is in Israel or is Jewish, you face all sorts of struggles in this region. Like, some cases you can't say that you're Jewish. And for certainly being Israeli is really difficult. But, like, just the Jewish aspect is a problem, or if people knew you came from Jerusalem. Even if you said, for instance, well, I'm an American, but I'm a correspondent in Jerusalem, like with the Jerusalem Post, for instance, which could be an honest story.
Yeah.
Rather than some, like, weird, complicated cover story. Even then, it's like, oh, but you're Jewish and Jerusalem Post. You're in Israel. Oh, even if they don't know you have an Israeli citizenship, you run it. It's like it's all a series of, like, weird little hurdles.
Yep.
So, but I dealt with the Palestinian stuff. I got used to, for instance, in the Palestinian territories, just telling people sometimes I'm Canadian because I felt it's easier than being American. Because being American, you already run into this whole issue in some places of people wanting to discuss, you know, oh, what about George Bush or this or that? It's like a huge headache.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, as an American, Jewish, Israeli, it's like you've checked all the boxes. That didn't help. Why can't you just be Finnish? You know, like...
It's so funny that these countries like Canada exist, like Americans do that saying they're Canadian, and British people do it claiming to be Australian.
Right.
Exactly the same dynamic.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to ask about, actually, is like, to me, it seems incomprehensible to go to Syria. That just seems like dumb. Like, dumb in a lot of ways.
I agree.
Especially being Israeli, I'm trying to imagine what's the positive. Like, does being Israeli give you a particular perspective, do you think, that other Western journalists don't have? A particular in?
I don't think it gives you an in, but I think maybe it does give you a perspective. Because, I mean, you know, we come across all these Europeans and Westerners who are trying to cover the Middle East, and often they're just like astonishingly naive and sometimes miseducated also about the Middle East, and they have to unlearn a bunch of the stuff they learned about the region in Western universities before they begin to really impact on the region. If you're Israeli, or if you live in Israel for a given number of years and really get to know the society well, you know, you have an insight into some of the things that make the region tick, into politicized religion, into sectarianism, into the intractability of conflicts,
mm-hmm.
into the role of tribes and families and clans. You know, if you get down to the heart of Israel, of Jerusalem certainly, you're going to come across a bunch of that stuff. So I think it does give you a perspective and an insight. And then if you can write in English,
mm-hmm.
where you're not competing with other people from the region, but mostly with people who are not from the region, then I think, yes, I think it does. In the same way that from the Arab world, you know, writers like the late Anthony Shadid, for example, who wrote for New York Times, obviously, you know, he was an American, but he was a Lebanese American. And undoubtedly his family background and so on gave him an insight, even though he actually only learned Arabic at a later stage for his career. He didn't know
Arabic. Really?
Yeah, but he. But nevertheless, just the whole family, I think, gave him an insight. And I think for Israeli Jews, it can be a similar thing.
Yeah, I think, for instance, you know, we forget how close these places are. You know, I mean, I can fly back to America, and ostensibly that's home or what have you, but, like, you know, Damascus is right there. If you're on the Golan, you can almost see it.
Mm-hmm.
These areas in Iraq are not that far away. Like, we are conditioned a bit to think that somehow, you know, Italy is close, but Iraq is far.
Right.
It's not. I mean, okay, the Palestinians are right here. The Palestinians are kind of part of Jordan and Jordanians. And then you've got tribes, and then the tribes are the same ones in Syria. And then you're in Iraq. Bang. It's not very far away. Like, so I think that we need to understand that. I think certainly if we care about Israel and the future of Israel, or we're wanting to be here a bit, it's important to understand Israel is part of this region. Like, Israel, this is where we are.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of people in Israel that came from those areas.
Yeah.
This is the mosaic that Israel is a part of, as well as it's a part of the Mediterranean, Greece, and things like that. But it's just not part of, like, Denmark, you know? Like, I think, as you said, for the Europeans that come here, there is, first of all, colonial baggage and arrogance. And second of all, it's as if I was sent plopped down in Papua New Guinea to report about it. I mean, there is this massive social distance, and there is a feeling, I think, when you see them, they operate a bit like, you know, super kind of foreigners, kind of white people in a context that isn't really theirs, which means they can kind of mock it and not really care about it. But what happens today in Syria will affect us tomorrow. I mean, we're talking about Iranian entrenchment, right? Shiite militias in Iraq. No, these things are on our doorstep. It's just a minute away.
Yeah.
And I think that that's... And the large things that take place in the region, like the Arab Spring or whatever, right? Like this globalized world. So what happens in Egypt or Tunisia somehow ends here. Or back and forth. Like, and that's one thing that certainly being here, whether you're Jewish or Israeli or whatever, if you've just lived here a long time, I think you see the region from here as opposed to seeing it from Denmark or something.
Mm. The other thing you asked about going to Syria specifically is that, you know, Syria arguably is the most important ground zero for geopolitics in the world today. I mean, I was just in Syria last week and I was in eastern Syria. We were talking the other day and we were counting, like, you know, seven different armies, seven different military organizations of many different kinds, from the Islamic State all the way over to the United States Army, operating in that tiny, collapsed, fragmented space, you know? And they include not only local superpowers, so to speak, like Iran and Israel, but they also include global superpowers, the United States and Russia, and also various other players, Turkey, the Syrian rebels, the Kurdish PKK, you know, you name it. It's, so it really is, it's the, Syria in many ways is the point at which the main powers, and in some ways maybe even the main trend lines of power in the world today, meet and clash. And there isn't anywhere else quite like that in the world today, I would say, where those issues are so starkly confronted. You know, Syria is a space in which the United States Air Force killed 200 men who basically were Russian soldiers in February 2018. So they were contractors, Wagner, all this bullshit. They were basically, you know, employees of the Russian state. Man, that's something on a historical level. Where the hell else has that happened, you know? And Syria, through its geopolitical, geostrategic positioning, and through the nature of what's taken place there, and through the nature of its alliances, has brought all that together. So in a way, as a, if you're doing this stuff, you know, it's tempting. I mean, it's fascinating. And to get into the weeds with that, into the granular nature of that, I can tell you absolute honesty, I mean, for me, it's been pretty much without doubt the most important professional experience of my life.
Wow.
You know? So that's what I say. And the other thing which you were saying is, of course, absolutely great. It's an absolutely dumb and stupid thing to do. And if anyone's listening out there, you know, don't do it, kids. Yeah. Well, there it is.
Have you ever been outed?
In real time, I have not. In retrospect, I have. I outed myself, actually, when I went to regime-controlled Syria in 2017. And afterwards, I took a decision, really. I decided to write about it. Because they hadn't discovered me. And if I'd wanted to, I could have kept this whole fake identity I'd created going and kept on going back and developed a second life as a British pro-regime activist in order to keep on going to regime control. So now eventually I would have got caught.
Yeah.
Eventually. So I thought, okay, I've done it once. It was cool. It was fascinating. I'm going to write about it. And then once I wrote about it, all hell broke loose because, of course, the people I'd been with suddenly realised who I'd been. And then they got very upset and angry. Well, that was that. So that was the only time.
Wow. I mean, did they email you and be like, what the hell?
Yeah. The only one who emailed me directly was a lady, a Syrian lady, actually, who'd been our guide in Aleppo, a regime, Ministry of Information employee, who wrote this furious letter to me saying, I always knew who you were. I knew. That's why I didn't let... She's got this weird convoluted thing, like, that's why I didn't let you go to speak to those people, because whatever. I assume that's because they've been called in by the ministry.
Right, obviously.
From Al-Khabarat, and they've been grilled. Other than that, no. But the fun bit, it's a bit naughty, but the fun bit was there were some quite impassioned Facebook discussions on the Facebook page of one of the dudes who'd organised the trip in Arabic, but I can read Arabic. So I was following those with great enthusiasm. And one of the little lines, I sort of cut and pasted and put it in my own face because it was so much fun. Because one of the guys at some point said, "This man has eluded the intelligence services of Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria. We have no way of knowing who he truly is." And I thought, no, I have to, I'm sorry, but I have to. That was funny. Anyway, that
was it. Wow.
Me? I don't know. No, I mean, In Iraqi Kurdistan, I mean, people always never cared if you're Israeli or Jewish. It's actually a positive thing. So even if I told people, like, oh, I'm a correspondent for the Washington Times or the National Interest or whatever, someone that was with me that knew me would always be like, yeah, but he's Israeli. And all the people would be like, oh, that's great. Well, so I never felt that. I think after I went, the more I started to go, I noticed that my trips got picked up in Farsi media and Arabic language media. And then, of course, people would find I'm perfectly public on Facebook. I'm not very secretive about things I do afterward. So, like, someone would find a picture of me in the Gulf in Dubai dressed in, like, a kandoor, like an Arab's costume. And then they'd find a picture of me, like, on the front line with Kurds. And then they put them together and say, you see, this high-level Mossad operative has now penetrated all these places. And you see what he's doing. He's met these Iranian dissidents in Iraq. And then he's been to the Gulf. And you see, it's all part of a vast conspiracy.
But you got into trouble in the Gulf once, right? The airport. Right?
I got stopped at the airport coming back. I mean, I was, yeah, I guess in a sense I was outed because I went to the Gulf. I registered for a literary festival, which is they happen every year. Right. I registered as Jerusalem Post. I wanted to see what happened. Well, they say no. They didn't say no. I went there. I had a friend there, a friend of mine I knew from social media. She hosted me a bit, and I had a good experience at the festival. I had no problems. I rented a car. I drove out to Al Ain on the border with Oman. I did nothing weird. I didn't meet dissidents or anything strange. I just did a totally normal thing. And then I mean, that was, of course, after the Israelis had assassinated that guy with that whole tennis racket thing.
Right, yeah, yeah.
I didn't go to that hotel. Anyway, I enjoyed my experience, and then I was kind of I had asked someone here about going, about bringing the Israeli passport, and they had just said, just keep it in your luggage, don't tell anyone, it doesn't matter, it's the Gulf, nobody cares.
Yeah.
So I was at the airport leaving, and I came to the first stop where you give the woman the thing and then she's going to stamp it. And then she said, oh, I'm sorry, there's just one little small problem, no problem. Just 1 second. And she scurried off. And I thought, oh, okay. And then she came back and she said, oh, could you come with me? There's just one small issue. And I was like, okay. And so I came with her and I sat in a room with like three other dudes that were from like Thailand or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, what's happened? Did they forget to stamp it when I came in or something? Because that happened to me years ago in like Africa somewhere. Someone forgot to stamp it and I was like, okay, they're trying to connect it up. Like, there was no, I was my American passport. It wasn't my Israeli passport.
Yeah, yeah.
So then she said, oh, it's fine. She brought it back and they let me go. And right after the passport was controlled, then there was a second line of security checks. And then all of a sudden, four dudes were standing around next to me. And I was like, yeah, there's a few more extra gentlemen in uniform and jackets than probably should be here. And they were like, oh, sir, just a random check. Would you just mind if we just go through your things? Everyone else is like going through quickly, right? Yeah. And I was like, yeah, okay, I guess. And I immediately realized, like, I had put the thing inside a book and just thrown it in the thing. And they were like going through every little thing. I was like, oh, no, not only are they going to go through, there's nothing secret in here to find, but like, eventually they'll come across the passport. So I could just tell them where it is.
Right.
I was just waiting. And I thought to myself, there was an old British couple next to me putting their shoes back on. I thought, you know, maybe I'll just give them a note saying, like, call my wife, I've been detained.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. Please do that. And I was about to do that. And I thought, like, well, I guess we'll see where this goes. Am I going to end up in, like, a fucking room with all those Thailandese guys now in some prison somewhere for, like, immigration? What have I done illegal? I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure what the law I've broken. It's not an enemy state.
Yeah.
So lo and behold, one of the fat guys in uniform probably pulls out the passport like he's found gold. And they're like, ah! And then they all scurry off. And I was like, yeah, okay, now what? I'm not being, like, beaten on the ground and handcuffed. So what is this? So then they come back and they're like, okay, thank you, sir. And all my stuff's everywhere. And I was like, okay, thank you, sir. And before the guy left, I asked one of the guys that looked like the chief in this jacket. I said, yeah, just 1 second. So what is this? I was like, can I come back to Dubai? He's like, yeah, yeah, you can come back. We just like to know who's in our airport. And I was like, okay. I put everything back in and I went and drank an entire fifth of whiskey and got on a plane.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I think that was the only time that something like openly like weird like that happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with the Kurds, like you were saying, it really isn't a problem. And that's true of Iraqi Kurds, and it's also true of Syrian Kurds, in spite of the political differences. Obviously, KDP, Barzani have very long historical links with Israel, so
right.
You kind of wouldn't be surprised that it's called the Israeli there. But it's true also in Syria with the PKK-related people. They have no problem with it whatsoever. They always known who I was since I first went in there in 2013, and they have no, they couldn't care less. They're also like off the record when they're not giving speeches. They're also pro-Israel.
Uh-huh.
In their sentiments, the Syrian Kurds. I think the Turkish Kurdish PKK people would perhaps be very different.
Yeah.
But the Syrian Kurds, because they are Syrians after all, and they're a Syrian minority that hates the regime.
Right.
So they're kind of like, well, Israel's cool because they were slapping the assets every so often. Right. You know.
Wow.
That was my experience there.
So that was one of the other things I wanted to ask about. That you know, just last month, the Americans pulled out and Turkey overran the Kurdish part of Syria. And so,
yeah.
I mean, people are talking about it like it's a betrayal of the Kurds by the U.S. government. I mean, do you think that assessment is true? And what does the future hold?
So it's interesting. I was just there last week, and I was actually focused on this story. And I interviewed Mazlum, the commander of SDF, and precisely on these questions, and I asked him those questions too. I mean, they certainly have a very strong sense of betrayal, but at the same time, they're very pragmatic. I think Kurds, that's something in their politico-cultural DNA, is they kind of like, maybe because they're accustomed to disaster, they don't assume it's going to come out well for them. So when it doesn't, they go, okay, this is very bad and unforgivable. Now how are we going to work with this?
Yeah.
The fact is, the Americans, as we know, have not totally left. They partially reversed in this weird, convoluted thing.
Yeah.
They have no real strategy, but as long as they're there, the Kurds in Syria will be happy to work with them.
Mm-hmm.
Because the alternative is not working with them, saying, we don't like you, you betrayed us, go away.
Right.
And then walking into a negotiating room with Ali Mamluk and Bashar Assad, naked, basically. Right?
Yeah.
Like, you're a local Kurdish force that has no friends anyway.
Right.
Or you can walk in there as General Mazlum al-Abdi, who, by the way, when I finish meeting you, Ali Mamluk, I'm going to go meet with Kenneth McKenzie.
Uh-huh.
If sent to under a CENTCOM, you know what I mean? So they prefer that, even if they're pissed off, and they are, and furious about what's happened, they're going to carry on working with the Americans for sure.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what it means on the ground, it's a fascinating thing. It hasn't been sufficiently reported yet. I'm writing about it now. Is that contrary to the initial impressions we had, that, hey, the regime's rolling in, it's all over. You know, on the ground, remarkably little has changed, whereas the Kurdish internal security forces are still responsible for security in all the urban areas. So you as a journalist, at least, right now, can go through the Kurdish controlled border crossing of Fishkabul Semalka, drive down to Kamishle without ever coming across a regime roadblock or even seeing a regime soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because the regime is very decrepit. I spent some time with the regime forces on the border in place of Tel Tamir, and the regime forces are in lousy shape. I personally witnessed a regime medical officer petitioning an American medical NGO for medical equipment in Tel Tamir. I don't have any aspirin for my boys. It was like that, you know? People tell me that they've had regime soldiers asking SDF guys for food. You know, so it's a ragged, decrepit army. It's won the war because of Russia and Iran, not because of any strength of its own. And that has implications for them taking control of the whole area. Because it's like, yeah, but are you guys in a fit state today? If you try and suddenly take over Kamishle, the SDF's got 100,000 guys. Maybe they'll go crazy. And the Russians will have another whole war in their hands in eastern Syria.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean? So it's everything's moving much slower and in a more complex way than the initial headlines after the American pullout gave the impression. The Turks, meanwhile, are still pushing forward. So there's fighting in Ain Issa going on just right now.
Wow.
Because they're trying to block the M4 highway. They can kind of like bisect the Kurdish entity. So it's all still much more complex and convoluted than the kind of simple, unattractive, but nevertheless symmetrical notion. Okay, there was a Kurdish autonomy, then the Americans sold them out, then the Turks moved in, now it's over.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like that, there's more to it.
Well, so this isn't the end of the war in Syria.
No. It's not the end of the war in Syria. My view is, you know, each war, it's like in the Bible, you know, the Bible, you have like Joseph begat Nimrod, begat, you know, it's like each war begats a new war, you know. So this war winds down, there's no war winding up, you know. Think about it, you have the regime rebel war, which gave birth to the ISIS coalition war, which has now given birth to a Turkish-Kurdish war, you know. Each one comes after the other. And there's a whole bunch of other ones as well, which I've mentioned, Israel, Iran, regime against Turks,
right.
Americans against Russians. Syria remains, I think that's a really crucial point, to be honest. I mean, Syria remains a confused, mixed up geostrategic space in which all kinds of forces are engaged, and that is currently the reality. Maybe 5 years from now, it will have played itself out and there'll be Assad once again with his flag on the whole country, maybe. But that is not the case right now. You know?
I mean, okay. Except?
Well, I would just say that the issue of the betrayal, which is interesting, that I looked at a lot, was, you know, the American messaging, this American foreign policy kind of just like bizarroness, which is that you have the State Department conducting one foreign policy and the Pentagon conducting another one, and maybe the CIA and the White House conducting two other ones, which is that, like, in the war, the CIA was involved in training the rebels originally, and then that program ended in 2017 after a billion was spent. The Pentagon was the one that kind of discovered the YPG and SDF, and in fact encouraged them to create the SDF. Like, this umbrella organization. And the Pentagon, you know, made all sorts of promises to these people in certain ways, or at least gave them lots of hope, having American flags everywhere. Like, it wasn't clandestine. They had guys with flags everywhere. So, like, you know, they were running a policy. The Pentagon people were not consulted about Trump's withdrawal. The State Department people, some of them were not consulted at all either. And I think that this American way of making foreign policy, which has been made worse by the Trump administration because it's so balkanized and it has so few people and it doesn't coordinate amongst itself, is really bad for the region, because countries like Russia and Iran, they make foreign policy systematically. Like, the Americans call themselves a Clausewitzian, like, foreign policy machine, but they don't follow Clausewitz. They don't combine diplomacy and arms, whereas the Russians and Iranians do. The Russians combine diplomacy. When the Russians say, we support this, the army also supports it. It's not like, well, the army supports this actor, but the Russian State Department supports this actor, and they fight each other. Mm-hmm. The American foreign policy actually has two groups fighting each other. So that the Americans that like Turkey are pleased to watch the other people that the Pentagon supported be defeated. That's insane that you have, like, people in the establishment cheering on different people as if it's a wrestling match while people die. It's insane. And the Iranians don't do that. The Iranians don't support Hezbollah to fight another Shia militia because it's funny. Yeah. No, they get them all to work together. It's, of course, in Iraq they might have dozens of different groups, and they have maybe one that they shower with praise one day and one another. But they don't purposely work against themselves. And the Americans do that. They purposely sometimes seem to work, at least in Syria, against their own interests, which is really weird. And I think leads all sides that work with America to feel betrayed. It means, for instance, Israel is suspicious of the Americans because Bolton told the Israelis, we're not leaving until the Iranians leave. That was bullshit, mm-hmm. apparently. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the Turks think that the Americans betrayed them by working with the PKK. And the SDF thinks that the Americans betrayed them by telling them, why don't you create the SDF? Oh, by the way, then we'll let the Turks attack it. That's it. Yeah. That's insane. The Americans trained 100,000 members of the SDF and then allowed the Turks to kill 400 of them. Why would you do that? Why would you train people and then let another ally kill them?
Right.
It's inexplicable. And never in history has that ever happened, I don't think. But it's one thing to betray people, by the way. Americans have betrayed other groups in the world. Like, Americans betrayed the people in South Vietnam or whatever, right, ostensibly. Yeah. But I don't think the Americans collaborated with another country to attack them. The Americans just left.
Uh-huh. They weren't secretly working with...
No, never in history has the U.S. government trained people and then encouraged another government to kill them. And I think it's very bad. And I think we see the way it works. And if you listen to language, you see the way the betrayal has unfolded, because you say, oh, I know what tactical and transactional means. When the State Department says it, that means this is a bullshit relationship. But the Pentagon is out there, you know, holding hands with everyone and giving them guns. I mean, one guy gives you a gun, the other guy says, no, that's actually just a tactical relationship. We'll let the Turks kill you. So, I mean, it's bizarre. Yeah, and I think that's not good in the long run, you know, regardless of what happens to the SDF. America and the region, every day, its brand is being eroded deeply. Like, you know, we're talking about like a brand that was like Nike or McDonald's. You know, and it's being eroded to the extent that it's in bad shape, I think. And that's not good for Israel or other allies.
So, the other current event thing that I wanted to ask about, and as an Iran lover, top of my mind, is all the protests going on in Iraq right now. I mean, the reporting saying that now Iran, they've overstepped their mandate, they've gone too far, the Iraqis are revolting, they're not going to put up with it anymore. I mean, do you think that's true? I mean, are the Iranians on the way out, as it were?
I wouldn't say they're on the way out necessarily, but it does indicate vulnerability, which has always been inherent in their empire building in the region, which of course is that they have no socioeconomic model of any kind, and they couldn't really care less about that, right? I mean, Qasem Soleimani can give you guns to revenge your humiliation at the hands of the Zionists and the imperialists. Right, but he has, and that's his selling point to you, right?
Yeah.
But he has no way. He has no idea how to create an economy in a country full of young people, who are desperate for a future, who are desperate for housing, who are desperate for jobs. The Revolutionary Guards Corps simply has no interest whatsoever in any of that. Which means that when they create the system, and then, by the way, I think in this respect, the American policy of maximum pressure is to some degree bearing fruit. I think there is a correlation between an absence of money in the Iranian coffers an absence of an ability to subsidize, you know, satrapies, and then discontent on the streets of those places. These things are causally connected, right. I would say. So in this respect, you put that the lack of an economic model together with real pressure, in this regard at least from the American side, it's not surprising that you get then discontent and fury. And each country, not in Syria, because Syria is in a different situation, still at war, but Lebanon and Iraq, and now Iran itself, are all producing remarkably similar, actually, you know, manifestations of this, in which clearly socioeconomic motivations, whether it's raising, you know, tobacco and WhatsApp prices in Lebanon, or fuel subsidies being removed in Iran, or whatever else, produce this furious reaction. Does it lead to profound change? My view is, as a student, if I may put it this way, of, let's say, of insurgency and political violence, is it almost certainly does not at this stage, because to have a revolution, you need a revolutionary party. It doesn't have to be a formal political party, but you need a bunch of people who want to make a revolution and yeah. want to steer it this way or that way. And that currently does not exist in any of those countries. But does it make life difficult for the Iranians? Does it keep them occupied? Does it make them have to think carefully about where and how to spend the limited funds and increasingly limited funds available to them? Yes, it does. And in that respect, I think it's very significant.
Yeah, I think the what's interesting is Iran was able to get into these countries usually by legitimately saying that not only is it a resistance, but it's working with the poor and downtrodden Shiites, which is that, I mean, legitimately, that's how I got into Lebanon. If I was a Lebanese Shiite, I would have supported Hezbollah as well. I would support Hadi al-Amri in the 1980s or whatever and fight against the Saddam regime, which is evil. I mean, that's fine. But the problem is, you fast forward to today, Iran works with now the older, fatter leadership. And so people are now resisting this kind of ossified resistance. And I think that, I think in Iraq, it's a fascinating degree to which when you get a bunch of young people together and they decide to riot, and people riot all the time in history, right, over bread or things. But these people immediately attack not the symbols of the Iraqi state, necessarily, but the symbols of the Iranian state. They attack, for instance, the Iranian consulate in Karbala, right? They attack the Shiite militia headquarters. So that's a very interesting thing. It means everyone kind of, what we've been saying, which is, oh, the Shiite militias are a huge problem. It's they're taking over Iraq the way the IRGC took over Iran. They're kind of seeping in. But we've always been saying, and people have been like, yeah, but is that really true? What's actually happening? Actually, the average guy who's like 17 or 19 years old immediately knows it's true. When he goes out to riot, he immediately attacks that office, and I think that says a lot. So
also, can I say one thing about that? I mean, also, because for the very clear reason that is plain that the militias have been used from almost day one of the riots in Baghdad as death squads.
Right.
And right now, I just before I came out, I was reading a quote from Al-Ghazali, right, from Asayi Bakr al-Haq, who's still coming up with this ludicrous explanation, which the state has been coming up from the beginning, which is like, no, there's the security forces and there's the rioters, and there's this weird third force that the Israelis and Americans and they're the ones killing demonstrators. You know, Iraqis are not stupid. When they hear something like that, you know, it's obvious what's behind it. Hmm. You know? So I think there's the anger at the militias also is very pointed, because the militias are the main spearhead, so to speak, of the repression that's been taking place. More than 360 dead now.
Wow.
Well, and no one thought that militias would end up this way, right? I mean, when people joined in 2014 to the Hajj, I mean, some of which were existing unions, but 100,000 dudes went and joined. They went and joined for very normal reasons, which is that ISIS was 10 kilometers from Baghdad. You better fucking join.
Yeah.
So imagine that, though. Only a few years later, this corrupt institution is being ordered to gun down and use snipers and even imported grenade canisters to murder people, of which I'm sure large numbers of those guys that are in the militias don't do. But there is an elite group of them, apparently guided somehow by Iran's hand, systematically murder people. And I think, by the way, the stuff I've seen, I sent you a video yesterday of the Iraq stuff. Once people have protested for a month and a half, they don't forget. Even if they're defeated, they will remember it 20 years from now, and they will tell their children about it.
Yeah.
And I don't think people will forget this, and I think that makes it an important moment to some extent in Iraq's history, which is that you can't just kill hundreds of people, because as you know, in an Islamic society, every guy who's killed, he's got a big family. No one will forget.
Right.
And I think that, I don't know what will happen. I don't think, as you say, it doesn't have political guidance. Because Iraq's leadership is so corrupted and so ossified that, like, it doesn't have that yet. So I don't see how it wins. But, okay, but it's there. And apparently will keep being there. And it shows that Iran, of course, has, you know, really faces an uphill struggle now in the region, which is that it's too powerful. It bit off more than it can chew. And it doesn't, like, it's not the genius actor that it was apparently behind the scenes years ago, like, oh, we've infiltrated everything. Okay, yeah, but now you've infiltrated too much.
Yeah.
You know, I think.
And what, like, Israel is doing something. Like, what are we actually doing? Like, what are, does Israel have a footprint in these places? Like,
I mean,
do we, I mean, is it possible to even know?
No, I think it's possible to know, certainly in terms of Syria and in terms of Iraq and Lebanon. Certainly in terms of Syria and Lebanon, from what I gather from the newspapers at least, Israel has more or less complete intelligence coverage of those countries, and a lot of resources is put into that. And tens of people in military intelligence are working on the Syria desk and the, of course, Lebanon desk. And, you know, that's something which Israel knows everything that moves, I think, in Syria and in Lebanon. Iraq, I think, less so, but now I think attention has been turning to Iraq over the last couple of years, so now they have a pretty good take on Iraq as well. My sense, at least, though, is that the Israeli goals are very limited and have no internal political relevance of any kind to those countries. Israel is just worried about the uranium project in each country, and it wants to act mainly from an intelligence and then a kinetic military point of view, to downgrade and eventually, hopefully, to destroy or turn back that project. But none of that, in a way, has, maybe it has knock-on implications. It doesn't have direct implications on stuff we've been discussing. What Israel, one thing Israel's not doing in any of those countries, as far as I'm aware at least, is, you know, cultivating actors within the political sphere.
The South Lebanese army.
This kind of stuff, yeah, all that stuff. That, I mean, precisely, I think, because of the South Lebanese army or South Lebanon experience, you know, that the very thought of that gives people in the Israeli system chills. Like, if you were to sit at home and then suggest that, they go, they get up as if you just, you know, secreted some toxin. You know what I mean? The system's terrified of that. So I think Israel's going, as far as I'm aware, there's no, you know, there was exception the very, very limited, extremely transactional to the nth degree relationship with certain small rebel groups in Quneitra province, obviously during the height of the rebel uprising in Syria. But beyond that, and you saw how quickly that died. And there, I think, unlike with the SDF and the Pentagon, there I think there were no illusions on either side. Because the rebel groups knew that Israel, when it left, would forget about them the next day. And Israel knew that if those guys ever rolled into Damascus, the first thing they would do would be to demand the return of the Golan Heights.
Right, yeah.
You know what I mean? So it was absolutely transactional. But beyond that, I think there's nothing. I think. Is that right? I mean, that's as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, the Iraqi government accuses Israel of airstrikes in Iraq. The Russians just released details, right, claiming four airstrikes in the last weeks or so, of which they claim Israel overflew Jordan to get to Abu Kamal or whatever, right? I mean, it's fine, but I mean, the Iraqis like to spread conspiracies, of course, about Israel, right? I mean, I think that from Iran's point of view, the typical thing is America and Israel, America and Israel, America and Israel. So, like, what, in Iraq, of course, they accuse the Kurdish region of being somehow close to Israel, or, for instance, during the referendum, it's a new Israel. It's a second Israel in the region. Even the Turks say that.
Yeah.
That's fine. I mean, whatever they say that. I mean, but I don't think, I mean, my experience in that region has been that, you know, there is reticence on both sides to have anything, to do anything. There's no interest in some sort of open relationship and stuff. Yeah. It was true during the referendum that some people there flew Israeli flags. Because there is this feeling that, you know, Israel was an enemy of Saddam. Israel was an enemy of the groups that these people were enemies with. So there is a lasting remembrance, because Israel had a relationship with the Kurds in the 60s and 70s. That's one that's well known, a clandestine relationship. But I just think that things that happened in the 50s and 60s, those kind of ideas of, oh, we'll train rebels here and do it. It's not just Israel, but America doing things like, you know, black ops and stuff. People just don't do it anymore. I mean, it's not that it's done secretly. It just isn't done. It's like the kind of wheel, that freewheeling era of like, oh, let's go train the Contras or the Sandinistas. It just doesn't happen. Like,
but the Iranians do.
The Iranians do. Groups in the region want America and Israel to do things like that. They're like, you know, Iranian dissidents, I'm sure, would love to have, like, arms and stuff to fight.
Yeah.
But nobody wants to do, like, secret airdrops and weird things like that. It's just like Western countries, of which Israel's somehow part of the West a bit, aren't interested in this. As you said, we're also a very narrow goal. I think that even the airstrikes we saw last week or whatever, what Israel openly talked about, they attacked the glass house, which is a huge building. They attacked, like, one room. I mean, like, this isn't shock and awe of the Bush era.
Yeah.
This is like pinprick and awe.
Yeah. Wow. So I wanted to talk about writing also. Because when I was reading both your books, I mean, the thing, the sort of book that I thought of was Orwell's Farewell to Catalonia. And that sort of role of the war reporter coming in, who's deeply embedded and knowledgeable and speaks the language and becomes part of the story as much as, you know, as much as an observer of the story. So I want to ask about sort of if you relate to Orwell in that sense as a writer, just because I'm curious, but also sort of how you relate to the tradition of writing of war correspondence, of foreign correspondence, like wearing that hat, not just sort of policy analysis, but you know.
I don't know about Orwell. I mean, I definitely think that when I sat down to write this book, and I really wanted to write it because I felt that I'd missed an opportunity in the past to write a book, and I had all this information. I originally wanted to write about the ISIS crimes because I felt that what I'd seen in Sinjar and the mass graves and interviewed survivors and stuff was as if I'd appeared in 1945 in Europe with the Allied armies in Berlin and gotten a chance to speak to people that had survived, I don't know, Buchenwald or Theresienstadt or whatever. So, like, I thought that was important to document that. I mean, I drew some thoughts from Tony Jute, even though he's an anti-Israel guy, but Tony Jute's post-war, about, you know, okay, the war ends, but wars don't end. They just, other things begin, right? So you defeat the Nazis, but then you got to fight the Soviets. I was thinking, like, in this region, you know, I've witnessed the crimes that similar to what the Nazis did on a much smaller scale. The Nazis are not defeated. ISIS was defeated. I witnessed that. I was in Mosul. Now there's going to be a new conflict with Iran or a fight over the spoils somewhere. So that was where I thought about it. I thought about, like, people that were correspondents in Vietnam, like the book Dispatches. I thought about, like, how do I blend a book that I want to tell a little bit of history. I want to talk about Sykes-Picot and the Ottoman Empire. I want to have it be chronological. But it's also going to be based on a whole bunch of vignettes of my own experience. Like, I was in Iraq at these times. So it has to be colorful in that time. And it's as if I was there for a bit longer because I have to tell a chronological story. And then I want to talk about the Gulf because I think the Gulf's important because it's the opposite of what ISIS was doing. ISIS was blowing up things like Palmyra, destroying history. Here you have the Gulf building all these new Palmyras. But those will be Palmyras in 2,000 years. People will look back at that stupid Burj Khalifa thing and be like, what the hell is that? Like, so I was thinking, that's kind of cool. I've got this juxtaposition. I went to West Africa. I thought that I'd seen the whole other flank of ISIS. I didn't get to go to Afghanistan, but if I could have, I would have gone to Kashmir or something. I think that I wanted to do Jordan and Egypt because I felt it's important to see how the state system had been eroded in the Middle East and then the state system had returned in a major way in Egypt, which is like total state, total North Korean style, like we will police you everywhere because we don't want to have ISIS or chaos. So I was very interested in trying to tell that story and like blend it a bit as a chronological history story, that, but not academic. But also as a bit of what I experienced, but not I did this, I did that. And then I wanted to have like a section at the end about like, okay, and then what comes next? And so I don't know if I, you know, I don't know if there was particularly numerous writers that I drew on for that. I've read a lot since I was a kid, so I tried to think like, what's the book that I would like to read about this? You know, and what's the book that's boring, by the way, because I read a lot of boring books. I read a book called Burning Shores about Libya before I started writing, and it was a very nice book. It was about a former State Department officer. It blended the history of the Libyan conflict, which is a really complicated conflict, from 2011 to 2014-15, with, like, his own experiences on the ground, and following a few characters. And I thought, like, that's kind of cool. I mean, this is a book that not too many people read, but I'd like, if my book is kind of accessible and, like, to a wider audience, but also to people that know about this, then I'll be happy, whatever. And anyway, I'm happy that I put it all in one place. And now it's a reference. And people can go back to it if they want or not, whatever.
I want to say, I mean, I agree with your, I don't know, I identify with your comparison. I mean, I do think, for me at least, those writers in the 1930s and 40s, if Orwell was one, Arthur Koestler was another.
Yeah.
There's a number of others who in a way, kind of created or helped to create that kind of genre, which you might call sort of literary war reporting or war reporting, but with in which the writer kind of becomes also present at certain points. I think they kind of pioneered that, and I do think Homage to Catalonia, and also Koestler has a number of books. I mean, he has a book called Promise and Fulfillment about Israel in 48-49, which in a way is a similar. He was already a bit older than him and a bit more established, so it doesn't have him going into weird places, but it combines his own experience. He lived here in the 20s with what's happening in 48-49. So there's a number of books of that kind that, yeah, I do think I like those kind of books. I like reading that kind of thing, like you were saying. That's the kind of book I like to read. if I hear there's a book like that written by a writer that I think is good about any given conflict, I'll jump at it. I think it's a fascinating way, and accessible and exciting, if you do it well, way of writing. So I definitely did, you know, I definitely felt, not that I was able to write anything as good as that, but that was kind of the model for the kind of thing that I was trying to do. Definitely. And the other thing is that it's a way of combining, hopefully at least, the insights available to a person who's reporting on the ground and the insights available to a person who does policy analysis. And the sense, as we were discussing before, the sense in which the one strengthens the other. You know, a person who knows the region he or she is operating in will be a better frontline reporter than one who's just parachuted in. You know what I mean? And a person, an analyst who has spent time on the ground and knows the smell and sights and sounds of the thing that they're analysing will be better and will have more insights, I think, and will be mistaken less often, not never, but less often, than the one who's just sitting in an air-conditioned room, you know, reading the internet and writing whatever comes out of that.
Right.
So I think there's an educational and professional value also to the combination of those two activities.
Do you ever feel like you were put in a situation where you crossed the line between observer and participant? I'm not trying to put a value judgment on that, but just to wonder about it.
I mean, I think I did to some degree in the summer of 2014 when, you know, we were discussing you were talking earlier about the ISIS onslaught of spring and summer 2014, which you know, ended up triggering, of course, the coalition response in August. I mean, I was there when part of that was going on, and it wasn't that I didn't pick up a weapon or something, but certainly the writing I was doing at that time was self-consciously trying to tell people that the YPG is a good organization, played a tremendously important role, is worthy of your support and regard. Yeah, I think I was at that point. I wasn't writing propaganda, I was just writing what I genuinely was seeing and felt. But, you know, there was a sense then where I wasn't just doing military analysis of the kind that I do for Jane's Intelligence Review.
Mm-hmm.
I was invested in those people at that time.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think so. And I think in the book I mentioned that. And I think I try and say in the book as well to qualify with the benefit of hindsight by sort of saying, you know, that doesn't mean, of course, that the PKK is a perfect organization or that it's not quite right to criticize it and X and Y. But at that place and that time, and I do still think this today, you know, at that place and at that time, at that moment, the YPG in eastern Syria, you know, were playing a tremendously ethical and moral role, were literally saving the lives of tens of thousands of people at a very high cost to themselves, with very primitive weaponry often and very primitive equipment. And that's something which I think is worthy of being, you know, acknowledged. I think it should be.
I don't really, you know, I know that we're supposed to talk about being a nonpartisan observer or whatever. I just think that you're always a participant, and I would prefer to just be honest about it. I'm a participant. I was happy to, of course, there's groups that I felt that it was important to, in a sense, participate more in, which is, I do think the guys fighting ISIS and stuff, it was important to be there. I did feel a commonality with the Jewish experience, meeting Yazidis and stuff like that. So you have to be a participant. I think that you have to choose sides in a pit. It's not like I'll cover ISIS too. It's like, no, I'm sorry, I just don't care. Look, I covered other places like Turkey or Egypt that are more complicated, because there is maybe being more of an observer, because I don't love the Egyptian regime. I don't necessarily like the Muslim Brotherhood either. So I'm just there. I see what it is. I was in Turkey at formative periods when it was transforming even more and more from just Erdogan's kind of light totalitarian state to more and more totalitarian state, to the extent that I wouldn't go back now. Like, and I think that, you know, I tried to give a fair shake to the Turks I met. I mean, I met a guy who was a member of the founding member of the AKP, who'd been a former foreign minister, who was very nice. I think I gave Yasin Aktay, who's an extreme Turkish nationalist, a fair shake. I mean, I tried to explain where Turkey got to these decisions. I didn't just say it's an evil totalitarian regime. I tried to understand, you know, how did their society change as well? So I tried to tell that story, but I think that, I mean, also, I think that anyway, like, when I went to Eastern Europe, there was a refugee crisis in 2015, which I covered, and it's in the book a bit. I wanted to cross the borders with the refugees, and I felt I wanted to cross a whole bunch of them. I thought, like, I want to follow this whole trail. I don't think you're really an observer. Like, I mean, you of course you're observing, but you're with these people. Like, I wanted to walk with them illegally across the Hungarian border. I wanted to understand, okay, what is this people experiencing? I want to sleep on the railroad tracks with these people. Like, and not in a romantic way, like, oh, you see, I did that, I'm so rough. I just felt like I want to get, you know, what's happening there, like, and that will help me understand it. And I gave a ride to a few of these people. There were some women that were walking in the cold, and there were some dudes with them. They were like Afghans. I guess they were Shiite Hazaras. And they were asked me if I give them a ride, and I said I didn't really speak their language. I said, okay, but how are the guys going to find the women? Because there were like seven of these people. They were piled in my car. I said, listen, you see that mosque over there? I'll just leave the women there, and you'll find them, hopefully. Good luck. And I gave them a ride. And then I met these other Afghans later who had their feet were very cold, and I gave them all my socks that I had left when I was about to leave. So, I mean, okay, I'm a participant. That's fine. I don't mind that. I mean, am I on the side of immigration to Europe? Not exactly. I think that Europe should regulate immigration. I learned from that experience the degree to which Europe is doing nothing to regulate immigration. I personally had to go through a checkpoint, a border legally, and then go back to do it illegally. And I saw how the European police, or border police in Greece, were pushing us physically across the border. The police were engaged in illegal activity. There was no one there to check the fingerprints or eye retinal scans, which, by the way, they had the technology. So I learned the degree to which, what a surprise, soon afterward, there were ISIS attacks. People came through those same borders. So, I mean, I would be a critic of unfettered immigration, but I would certainly be sympathetic to those people, and I was glad to have met them and seen, you know, what's actually going on. Is it all Syrians? No, it's not. It's Afghans. Is it all men? Well, no, there are some women. So, and some of them are Kurdish and Yazidis. So that's that was interesting. I just think we're always participating, especially if we're going to be on the ground with people, and especially if you're sharing a trench or sharing a tent with people that could die. Like, of course you're with them. You can't pretend that, yeah, but I also with the other guys. I'm not.
But I think what you said raises two points. Firstly, just in terms of what we were saying earlier about the way in which you gain insights from being on the ground as an analyst. You just described an example of that, right? That you saw things there, which later on in your work as an analyst gave you an insight which you could not possibly have got in another way. I think that's an important point. The other thing I think is an issue with regard to this thing of being a participant, which just struck me while you were describing what you just described, which is that I think, at least from my experience, there is a way, though, of doing the kind of close observation that you're talking about whilst radically not becoming a participant. In other words, remaining radically opposed to the people you're hanging out with.
Right.
And in a kind of human and chemistry level, it'll be exactly... I've done this with the Syrian... Two examples, really. Well, three examples, really. The Syrian regime, with ISIS people, and with the Shia militias, where I spent some appreciable amount of time with them, with precisely those kind of experiential aspects, with, you know, the human stuff of them being interesting human beings, and with the sense that, not that they necessarily have a case, that's maybe too strong, but they come from somewhere, they're not just like crazy psychos in toto, they have reasons why they got to where they got to. So in that sense, you're observing close on, in the sense that you're talking about, you are genuinely interacting in the way that humans interact, and you can't avoid that. But you also remain absolutely not a participant in their project, and indeed actually strongly opposed to it, you know, participant against their project, if anything.
No, I agree. Look, when I used to cover Palestinian riots and clashes, of course, I would often be with the Palestinian guys. I mean, they're throwing rocks at the Israeli forces. Of course, actually, my actual identity is more the Israeli forces. But I guess it's a question of where is the participating drawing line? I guess you're right. We're not picking up rifles and supporting people. That's obviously beyond what people should be doing if you're a journalist. But I mean, I guess what I meant is that, like, so, you know, certainly you have an emotional connection to things, and, like, you are choosing to stand, where you choose to stand matters a bit, and, like, you can stand with people that you actually deeply loathe or oppose, or actually maybe come to hate them because of it, or maybe come to like them, I don't know. But, I mean, I just think that there is a myth sometimes about the idea of the neutral observer, as if you're really truly disconnected from things. I mean, I think that it's like, okay, we're there, and I think at certain points in history it is actually important just to make the decision to actually choose sides in terms of the writing or write about, this is what should be done. Yes, sometimes doing analysis, and it can be kind of a bit neutral. But then there's also a time to write an opinion piece saying, well, this is actually what should happen. These people are very, you know, I don't know. So there's it's interesting to be in that spectrum somewhere, I think.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the Yazidis before and identifying as a Jew with their, like, terrible, terrible experience, which I totally understand. I'm just imagining sort of being in that position and being in these places and seeing a lot of stuff which is extremely traumatizing. I mean, for you as individuals, like, things blow up and you're there and people shooting at other... Like, that is... I can only imagine that that's inherently... That it leaves a mark. And I'm just wondering, what do you, like... there's a certain image of the reporter, the correspondent who goes and writes it down, then comes back home, and it's like, as if
the,
that
I think the image is the reporter is always drunk and drives himself to suicide.
No, really, but like, what do you do with that? What do you do with those... What do you do with those traces? Well,
you and get
that?
Drunk and you commit suicide. I mean.
Yeah. No, look, it's a problem. The more of this stuff you experience, I would say that I've had two reflections. First of all, the more trauma you get or PTSD or whatever it is that you have when you have that, or the adrenaline kick, the kind of fix that you get from it, the more you want of it. So you leave a situation where there's explosions that are, you know, and then when you come back to civilian life, sometimes you might even hear sounds that remind you of that, and you kind of are like, yeah, I wish, A, it freaks you out, and second of all, you wish you were back there. And it is a fix. It's an adrenaline thing. It's a high. It's like, I think surfers and race car drivers get it. I think that it's even people in combat. I was never in combat. You were a soldier. But, like, people want to go back, some of them. Some of them, of course, don't ever want to go back. And they might have been at the D-Day invasion, and then their entire life never spoke about it. Mm-hmm. I know my great-grandfather fought in the First World War. I don't think he ever really talked about it. I think it was very bad. It's a mix. So I think that there's that. I think also you find if you do it too much, you can kind of only really talk to people who've also done things like that. Either other correspondents or people that were soldiers or were in, or did other stuff or were humanitarian aid workers. Like, those are the kind of people I can talk to about things like this. Other people, I half the time just think what I'm saying is boring and I just don't, you know. People ask weird questions like, oh, did you see dead bodies? Oh, what's it, you know, what's it like to kill? I don't know. People ask weird things. You're like, yeah, okay, we just can't have a conversation about this. Because war is, I don't know. It's like, so you realize, A, you've joined a weird little fraternity. And the more you do it, the more you're in a weird segment of that part. And also, you realize a bit to the degree to which it's addictive. And maybe that's a, and you have a realization that it's a bad, weird addiction because you're not supposed to like it, but you do. And then maybe at some point you also have an experience. Like, I had two kids while this was going on, or my wife did, and I realized at some point I can't do this anymore. I mean, I did, the things I did years ago, I would never do again. I mean, I would not take the weird things that I chose to do. And there was a point at which I chose not to do certain things because I felt that it was a risk to her and the kids, and it wasn't nice for them to grow up without a father, and she would be unhappy if I was wounded or some weird shit. So there's that. Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I have a similar view. I mean, I just think that, yeah, it is a big deal. I like it for all kinds of reasons, and I do think that it does give a kind of vividness to life and experience in those situations. You have a sort of intensity of experience, which is quite hard to find elsewhere. So I think in that sense, it's not surprising that people wish to experience it again, you know, because it provides that, and it's very difficult to find parallel examples of where you can find that. Mm-hmm. So I think that's definitely true. And the other thing is, in terms of being traumatized, I don't know, I think that one has to, you know, it's kind of the thing in our society today, certainly to regard soldiers who've experienced combat, so, okay, this person is probably traumatized. And as far as I'm aware, I'm no expert, but I think I've read some accounts which say, you know, actually the military psychologists will tell you that, you know, only a relatively small minority of soldiers who experience combat actually are diagnosed with PTSD. And that applies to guys like ourselves as well, I think. You know, there are many people, and I can think of other people we both know and others, who just do this stuff and continue to do it and have successful family lives and are just regular people. You know what I mean? So I think there's lots of people like that, and not everybody is hugely affected by it, and everyone's affected differently, you know.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay. Interesting. I mean, it's funny because we live in this oversaturated media environment, right? Where I know that I feel this as a writer, where, you know, I write a piece and then it goes out in the world, and then there's like 10,000 other smart hipsters writing pieces, and my little article about ice cream or whatever, who cares? But you know, when you're writing about something which is so much more important, right, in the sense of conflict and people's lives are at stake and, you know, the political future of the region, all these things.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think your work has an impact? I mean, is that
absolutely
a concern, or is that a...
I read somewhere that, like, intelligence organizations and others, like, grade information into different grades, like grade A, grade B, grade C, and most of the time you're dealing with grade C.
Yeah.
By the very nation, and occasionally you're dealing with grade B, and once or twice in her career or whatever, you're dealing with grade A. And that's very much the way I see it with my own writing. At least the vast majority of it's great C, so to speak. It just goes out there and it hopefully informs whoever reads it and is forgotten fairly soon. There is an ephemeral nature to journalism. Hopefully the books that we're writing is a bit different. You don't want the book to be ephemeral, but a news article kind of deserves to be ephemeral, mm-hmm. and it's okay, you know. Mm-hmm. And then there are occasional moments where you kind of go, okay, this was the point where, you know, it was doing, I was doing what everyone when they become a journalist think it's going to be like, you know. And that's very rare, where you actually are dealing with a story that nobody else knows about, that you've kind of got, that you're chasing down, that you get it, and then that you do think, hopefully at least, you do feel has had some kind of impact, at least on the discussion, at least on the policy discussion, on the policy outcome. It's maybe another thing, but at least on the discussion. And there have been a couple of occasions where I've felt that, and that's fantastic.
There's a lot of satisfaction that comes from hitting that.
Yeah. And then you feel that, you know, you feel justified to some degree in terms of the whole project of what you're doing with your working life and so on and so forth. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it's a struggle. Like, I do think one of the disappointments you feel sometimes out in the field is that you go, you know, you're sitting in some bourgeoisie Western place, or and you plan the trip, and then you get there, and then you meet other journalists along the way. You meet some of them in the capital, like Erbil or whatever, and they're hanging out. And then you go to the field, and you see more of them near the front line. They're hanging out, and then you're like, "Fuck this! I'm gonna go further." And you go to some place they're not there anymore, and you get interesting information. And you know, sometimes you write it, and sometimes it has an impact. But oftentimes you realize that the guy who never even left his chair back in New York wrote an article while you were there. That appeared in a very good publication, and you're like, well, that doesn't seem fair. That's sometimes the thing, but I do think on the positive aspect of all of it is that you go to all these places, you see different things, you can, hopefully, you learn to connect all sorts of dots. And I think that eventually, you come to the point, especially if you're trying to bridge a bit between the reporting and the analysis bit, or, you know, briefing people or whatever, and saying what's going to come next, how does it all work together, how does the puzzle piece, it's not just a bunch of pieces,
right?
It's a puzzle. Then that what you've got, having done it a long time, and especially seeing and talking to people again and again on the ground, and staying with the sources over the years, developing a source who by the years ago was just some random guy, and now he's the advisor to the foreign minister of the country you were in, all of a sudden you've got to this unique place that you see the whole elephant. And then then the other people don't. And then you got it. And then you say, yeah, fuck, this little thing here, this is going to cause a fucking war. Like, you know, you, and then I think that's the kind of cool place to be a bit, is to realize that you've made a few determinations that are entirely correct based on what you've learned. And that's kind of nice. Otherwise, as you said, you're parachuting into a place like the West Bank or whatever, you could write the same story for 10 years, and you could always say it's a crisis or it's not. But you never really know, because you haven't been through like 35 armed conflicts in Gaza. You haven't sat under rocket fire for 10 years. So, you know, you can't see what's different.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's cool about it. And so you may feel on the journey a bit disappointed at certain periods.
Yeah. You know? I think that's right. I think a lot of journalists also are just quite lazy. Not everybody wants to be doing this stuff and taking it as far as it can go, and is interested also in policy analysis and policy formulation and all that stuff. You know, we are and others are, but there are many other journalists who just see their job as, you know, they need to write a story and get the story out. Many of them are not, you know, you see all the time in news reporting from Iraq or from other places where, like, the same story basically is written by 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 different reporters.
Yeah.
That's because they're all looking at the same source. Probably they're all hanging out together. And they will, okay, let's just go and write the stories now and then go and have a drink or something.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of journalism like that as well. And the other thing is, because journalism's in trouble as a business model, what there also is, which I think characterized to some degree the Iraq and Syria conflicts quite a lot, is that you had lots of people, sometimes very young people, sort of trying to make their names as journalists by kind of absolutely piling in there, often with no adequate professional backup, no adequate professional training, no adequate security nous and knowledge. And some things went very wrong with that. And maybe occasionally some of those people got great stories, but frankly, a lot of them ended up, from my experience of reading a lot of their stuff, a lot of them ended up writing the same article, mm-hmm. not even necessarily knowing it, but, you know, having the same experience with meeting the same dude in Aleppo, writing about him in the same way. Yeah, there was a lot of stuff that didn't cut the mustard. So there's gradations of this stuff as well. It's not that everyone's the same, but, you know, there are gradations of the level of seriousness, the level of commitment, and so on.
Right. And the level of knowledge.
And the level of knowledge, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I think that's all I got. And it's a nice place to end, actually.
No. I hope we don't lose the recording. We'll have to do all this again.
Yeah, no, if I lose the recording.
That'd be unfortunate.
You just make it up.
That's what I normally do.
Right. Isn't that what we all
do? Cool. Do you want to get something?
I might wander over to Crave or whatever, grab a sandwich. Okay. Don't worry, I'll eat something.
Yeah, because this is on me. It's on the.
Oh, well, had I known that, I would have ordered massive amounts of food. No. I was going to sit and maybe just read after this or something, or I don't know. So maybe I can go home.